Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio, your source for acceptance, enrichment, inspiration, and empowerment within the autism and Asperger's communities. Our show will be starting shortly. To listen to archives of previous broadcasts, visit www.autismempowerment.org and click the Autism Empowerment Radio tab. As a nonprofit charity, we rely on public generosity to fund our programs, special events, and support services. Thank you for considering a tax-deductible donation today. Our show is now beginning.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio. My name is Karen Krecha, and I am the co-founder of Autism Empowerment, and happy to be your host for today's show. As you heard in our pre-recorded intro, Autism Empowerment is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we are dedicated to making life more meaningful for children, teens, adults, and families in the autism and Asperger communities locally, regionally, and worldwide. We're here to support you with resources, training, special events, a great Facebook community, and programs that you're listening to today like Autism Empowerment Radio. We invite you to become more connected with us after the show. You can do so by visiting us on our website at www.autismempowerment.org. And if you're new to Autism Empowerment, you can get to know our mission, our vision, our positive core values, and our beliefs. You can also connect with us through social media. We are heavily engaged there as well. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Flickr, Tumblr, and LinkedIn. And when you go to the autismempowerment.org website, just look in the upper left corner and you'll see all the cool icons to link to those social media venues. We're always looking for help and volunteers, so if you are interested in connecting with us, please go ahead and let us know, because we would love to work with you too. So today's show recording date is Friday, December 13th, and my special guest for the day is Dr. Amy Donaldson, who is the director of the Portland State University Autism and Child Language Disorders Laboratory in Portland, Oregon. We're going to be talking about the Social SIBS Project, which is a study of social communication intervention that benefits children on the autism spectrum and their siblings. It sounds like a really cool program. I know a little bit about it, but I am anxious to learn more today, so that'll be quite interesting. But before I bring Amy on air, I just have a couple quick announcements. First, I'd like to thank our recent guest, Julie Borghello from Salmon Creek Top Soccer. She was on air with us on Monday, December 9th. For those who may have missed the show, Top Soccer is an inclusive soccer program, and it's for children ages 4 and up, actually adults too. And there, it's for individuals on the spectrum with any type of special need. It's really for all abilities. It's an inclusive program. So if you've ever been interested in soccer for your child, teen, or adult on the autism spectrum but didn't know if they were ready to jump into a regular soccer program, it's a fabulous welcoming program to check out, and they actually exist throughout the country. So if you missed that show and are interested, feel free to check it out in our archives anytime on demand for free at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you subscribe to our show through iTunes, you can download any of our shows to your mobile device, share them with friends, and you'll be able to check in that way as well. Also, something kind of cool. After this show airs today, my husband, John Krecha, who is Program Director for Autism Empowerment's Autism and Scouting Program, he and I get to go on a field trip. Well, not exactly, well, a field trip, I guess. But what we get to do is we get to go pick up 56,400 sheets of paper and figure out how that's going to fit into our vehicle. Hooray for spatial planning skills, right? But it's not any paper. This is the final printing of the Autism Empowerment Autism and Scouting Leadership Training Kit Manual, and that is going to start shipping throughout the United States next week. Our accompanying DVDs that go along with that manual will be back on Tuesday, so we will begin the process of assembling, packing, and shipping throughout the country. This is part of our Autism and Scouting program that's gotten a lot of really great press recently. It's a lot of work, but it's a labor of love because the kits that are going out are directly supporting thousands of youth on the autism spectrum involved in scouting and alternative scouting organizations throughout the country. And we would like to spread that around the world. So if you know anybody who's a volunteer leader in Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Campfire, Trail Life USA, America, American Heritage Girls, basically any type of scouting or scouting-type organization, invite them to visit the Autism and Scouting Program section on our website, and then they can pre-order a free kit. We truly believe that everyone can make a positive difference and that each has the capacity to be ambassadors for acceptance in our homes, in our communities, and in our world. And we appreciate every single like, every single share, everything that you can do to kind of help us out in the greater autism world. And a quick note, for those who are new to our show or even those who've been listening for a while, you may or may not know that Autism Empowerment is more of like a small grassroots organization, but we've got a big mission and we've got a big heart and big plans. Unfortunately, we don't yet have the big budget to match all the great programs and services we have in development, like our Autism Serves and Autism Mentors program that we're looking forward to getting launched in 2014. So we're trying to take a look at creative ways that we can secure funding for autism empowerment without hounding and inundating people, making them feel awkward. We want to ask you to give, but we're trying to do it creatively. So we're thinking now of corporate giving matching volunteer programs that we might be able to apply for from small to large. So if you're out there listening and you work for a company or a spouse or family works for one and they have some sort of corporate giving program, could you please let us know? Because a lot of times companies will donate to organizations that their employees care about or volunteer for. And this is one really easy way that you can help support our organization and make a positive difference for those in the autism community. We thank you for your consideration. And, you know, anyone who knows me knows that asking for money and those kinds of things isn't easy, but I know we have to do it. The fun thing is actually being able to make that meaningful difference and make things better for our children, teens, and adults on the autism spectrum. And the person that we're bringing on air today is doing that every single day in her work. We're very interested to be able to listen to what she has to say. Dr. Amy Donaldson is an educator, and she's an assistant professor. She's in the Department of Speech and Hearing Sciences at Portland State University, and she's dedicated to helping the everyday lives of children on the autism spectrum at the Autism and Child Language Disorders Laboratory. The research she does focuses on the assessment and intervention of social communication skills in children with autism spectrum disorder within the natural environment, as well as interventions and how effectively they work. So we're going to go ahead and bring Amy on air because she's going to talk about that much more efficiently than I will, and you've heard me long enough as it is. So let's go ahead and bring Dr. Amy Donaldson on air. Amy, welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Well, thank you, Amy. It is absolutely great to have you. And, you know, if I ask questions and I'm not asking quite the right thing, I hope that you can kind of just jump in and clarify for me, because this area of work that you're involved with is something that I don't have much experience in, but I'm very interested to know about. We're going to be discussing the Social SIPS Project for most of the show, but before we get into that, would you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. So I am a speech-language pathologist, and I have been practicing for over 18 years now, and pretty much exclusively with children with autism spectrum disorder and their families for about the last 13 years. And I very much enjoy working with families and trying to determine ways that they can feel successful in their social communication skills and social interactions with others. I did my master's degree work at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and became a speech-language pathologist through that degree, and then worked privately in private practice and in schools and in different settings in the Bay Area of Northern California. And that's where I really came to realize that a lot of the things that I was seeing happen in terms of the intervention services offered for children on the spectrum in particular didn't have a very large evidence base at that time. And so I've I found that the families I was working with were really feeling unsure and uncomfortable and kind of scrambling to know what would be a good match for their family. And that really drove me to want to pursue not only my doctoral studies, but then be able to contribute to our understanding of which interventions are effective for kids on the spectrum. So I went to University of Washington for my doctoral studies and was able to stay on as faculty at the University of Washington Autism Center and in the Department of Speech and Hearing Sciences there, and really learned a great deal about interdisciplinary practice and serving kids on the spectrum and identifying the ways that we can best support families. In 2009, I came down to Portland State University and joined the Department of Speech and Hearing Sciences here and started the Autism and Child Language Disorders Laboratory, and have just been so honored to be welcomed by the autism community here in Portland, and really excited to work with the students and the colleagues that I've worked with to support families here in the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area.
Well, that sounds absolutely great, and we're very happy. As someone who lives in Vancouver in the Portland metro area, we're very happy to have you doing the work that you're doing. I was wondering what made you decide, you said you've been involved for quite some time, what made you decide to focus on a career in autism research? Is there anyone that's close to you on the autism spectrum, or how did this become your focus and passion?
That's an interesting question, Karen. Actually, when I was receiving my master's degree, I really didn't hear much about autism spectrum disorders. At that time, it wasn't as common for us to have the experience or the opportunities to work with kids on the spectrum and their families. And so I really had no idea that autism would be what I was quite interested in as I developed my career. When I moved to California and we started seeing higher prevalence rates in the kids that I was just happened to be working with, we realized that there was a definite need in the community, and I worked with a really lovely woman who was the owner of a private practice, and she had a great vision, Pam Joy at Associated Learning and Language Specialists, and she wanted to start a school for kids who had communication challenges, and I was director of that school, and we started with three kids and me as the teacher, and when I left 5 years later, there were like 75 kids and, you know,
wow,
seven classrooms from infants to kindergarten, and multiple staff, occupational therapists and educators, and it was really so amazing to see when you offered something to the community, how quickly they responded because of the need. And so what ended up happening is I would say between 70% to 80% of the kids who were coming to seek services really ended up qualifying under an autism diagnosis. And so it really kind of came to me to start working with families and children on the spectrum.
That's very neat. And how exciting to be part of something that was obviously so well-received and able to grow. And you mentioned just earlier that you founded, you're the director of the Autism and Child Language Lab, but it sounds like you founded it there as well. Is that correct?
Right. And so really the Autism and Child Language Disorders Lab is a lab that allows me to do what I love. And so I was very fortunate. Portland State University has given me a wonderful environment in which to grow our lab and to build the research that we'd like to do. It really started when I came in 2009 to PSU with myself and about three students who were interested in autism and you know, wrote a grant to start working with kids and families in the community and started building what we were doing with the community. And I'm really so pleased to be working with now about, we have 12 to 13 students in our laboratory and staff and folks who are practicing clinicians who are working on our projects. And so it's really developed into a wonderful environment for us to investigate intervention efficacy and to work with families in the community.
And you know, I think what you're talking about, you know, evidence-based interaction, I mean, interventions, I should say, there's so much that's out there, but to actually, for parents, for us to know what is going to be really effective and to know that, you know, you're setting that through your program, the Social SIBS program, and I'm really interested in having you, you know, talk about that in just a moment, but something that was kind of cool that our listeners aren't aware of is that Amy and I, we both are on the editorial advisory board for Spectrums Magazine, which is a magazine supporting children, teens, and adults on the autism spectrum in the Southwest Washington, Portland metro area. Spectrums Magazine is a really good thing, but that's how we met. And you told me when we met that students in your class actually were required to listen to shows at Autism Empowerment Radio, which I think is kind of funny. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because in addition to doing your lab work and all of the studies there, you actually still teach as well. Is that correct?
Right, that's correct. And I was so pleased to find the resource of Autism Empowerment Radio. I teach a number of different classes, primarily related to this topic. I teach autism both at the undergraduate and postbaccalaureate as well as the graduate level. And I teach here at PSU, and I actually also teach autism at University of Oregon. And so I'm very committed to the two things you just talked about, Karen, which is our students having a really strong understanding in how we analyze and determine the efficacy of an intervention, the effectiveness of an intervention. And so we work a lot with the students on recognizing how to look at the research and determine where it falls along our levels of evidence, and so that we can be informed and help families kind of navigate those waters of what interventions might be effective for their children on the spectrum. And the second piece that I'm very committed to in teaching on this topic is helping them to develop a broad perspective on autism spectrum disorders. I'll give you a little of my own personal history. I had mentioned that I went to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. for my master's degree. And for folks who don't know, Gallaudet is actually the only deaf liberal arts university in the world. And so all of the undergraduates and graduate students, all of the undergraduates are hard of hearing or deaf. And then they allow graduate students who are hearing in certain disciplines. And so it was a really incredibly humbling and yet life-changing experience for me to go to Gallaudet, and I actually met my husband there, and he is deaf, and my children are bilingual in American Sign Language and spoken English. And from a deaf community perspective, deafness is a cultural and linguistic minority, not a disability group. So I really have high regard and very much want to demonstrate to our students who, in our discipline, we can sometimes have a very medical model of what we view as quote-unquote disability. And so I would like for our students to understand that there's a cultural perspective to everyone and the people that we serve. And so bringing that back full circle to autism, I make a very strong commitment in my classes to have students understand that there's a continuum of experiences that people and families on the spectrum experience, and introduce them to the notion of neurodiversity, and really make sure that they have the opportunity to hear voices of different ideas and perspectives, and of course that includes voices of people on the spectrum and families of children on the spectrum. And so we, in my graduate course, we listen to Autism Empowerment Radio. We do blog posts from lots of different perspectives, from family members, from individuals on the spectrum, from different medical facilities and their viewpoint on autism. And then in my undergraduate class, I always have them read a book that is either a first-person perspective on autism or a family member's perspective on autism, because I really want them to not just come in with kind of a narrow sense of what autism means.
That, wow. I wish, you know, people should replicate exactly what you're doing. That's great. I mean, as a woman on the autism spectrum, I think a lot of times it's so hard to get the point across to others that there is a huge culture in the autism community. And unfortunately, there's a lot of infighting and a lot of that politicking and stuff. I don't know if that happens within the deaf community, but I know also, you know, that there's a very big culture there as well. And I think that to be able to expose your students to sort of a comprehensive, you know, overview and being able to see different perspectives is really going to help them in working with kids and adults on the spectrum. So wherever
I certainly hope so. And, you know, I have to say that when I first started working with folks in terms of students and helping expose them, I'll admit that I had a commitment to kind of saying you have to understand, you know, I'm speaking about the notion of deaf culture and taking a medical lens off of it. And actually it's my husband who's helped me temper that over my career and say, you know what, you're not going to convince everybody that they need to have a cultural lens. You're going to just expose some of them. And I think that that's what I've come to realize. And I think that that in and of itself is a really significant thing to do, is to just know that you're not necessarily going to convince someone that there is a broad way to look at a particular issue or a particular community, but the fact that they've now heard that there is another way of thinking about it, I sometimes have to be satisfied with that.
You never know, too. I mean, what you're exposing to now and how long that's going to, you know, where that's going to hit them down the road, and, you know,
right.
What you're doing is a really awesome thing. So even setting those seeds, you know, or the, you know, everything into motion. So thank
right,
you.
Right. Planting the seeds. I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
So as far as your work here today, we're going to be talking about the Social SIBS project, the research project that's going on there at PSU. And people who've come to our events or, you know, seen us recently in the community may have seen the brochures we have out there, but most of our listeners are probably unaware. So I was hoping you would take the time to tell us about this great project, how it came to be, and what the purpose behind the program is.
Absolutely, and I actually would like to start with acknowledging and sending out my great appreciation and gratitude to organizations like yours and to personal colleagues and networking, because that's the way we've been able to spread the word and make sure that the folks who are interested in participating have the information to connect with us. And so that's a really huge piece when it comes to doing research, is being able to have a community that supports you and helps you get those contexts spread out so that everyone has an understanding of what's happening. I also want to just start by saying this current project wouldn't happen without the funding of Autism Speaks, and so we, of course, have just a large amount of gratitude that we were awarded a treatment grant through Autism Speaks that has funded this project, and it's a 2-year grant, and we've actually just completed our first year and are heading into our second year, and so that, of course, is what's causing this to happen, because without the funding, we wouldn't be able to do so. I also, if you'll bear with me, I just wanted to acknowledge the children and families who have participated in this project, as well as the student clinicians here at Portland State University. I'll explain their role in just a moment. And this really started as some of my students being interested in investigating this question with me. And so I've had graduate students who have piloted this study in order for us to receive funding from Autism Speaks. And that includes Megan Neely and Hannah Sanford and Leanne Hitty, as well as our current students are Alex and Heather, and our supervisor on the project is Tammy Bailey. So I just wanted to have acknowledged everyone before I get going to say this is absolutely a team effort, and we have been so lucky to have a great team. The Social SIBS project itself is kind of a continuation of what I have done clinically for many years, and that is try to involve families as much as possible when I'm intervening with a child on the spectrum. And what we've done is investigated effective methodologies for teaching social communication skills to children on the spectrum. And we've joined two together that have been found to be effective for this project. One of them is called peer mediation. And peer mediation refers to working with a peer to work with a child on the spectrum. And there's been two routes that peer mediation has taken in the past. The first route is that you train a peer to teach a child on the spectrum different skills. And then the second route is you train a peer to use different strategies and kind of change the way they communicate in order to facilitate social and communication opportunities for the child on the spectrum. And we take that latter approach. Some of the challenges to peer mediation in the past have been if that peer goes to a new classroom or moves away, when that peer is not present, then some of the gains in social communication skills that have been observed for kids on the spectrum have not been sustained. And so generalizing those skills has been really challenging. So one of the things we wanted to do was to combat that generalization challenge. And we felt, given our family-centered focus, that one of the best ways to do that would be to have the sibling actually be the quote-unquote peer, because that sibling is most likely not going to be moving away, is going to have many opportunities across multiple contexts to be with their sibling on the spectrum and supporting that child. And so we hope that that will then carry over some skills to the community that weren't happening in some of these other contexts in the past. And the peer mediation, now it is the sibling mediation model that we follow is that we use what's called pivotal response training. And that's actually the overarching approach to intervention that we use. And pivotal response training was developed by the Kegels and Laura Schreibman. And it is a naturalistic ABA-based intervention that really focuses on motivation for the child, implementing intervention within a natural context, promoting initiations by the child on the spectrum, and responding to all of their attempts to communicate, because social interaction is really at the heart of it. And so what we do is we actually follow a model that was developed by Pearson Schreibman in 95 and 97, where they taught these PRT strategies to peers, and we followed their model and we teach them to siblings. And so some of the strategies that we teach are things like, you know, gain your sister's attention before you say something. Offer choices so that your brother will be interested in what it is that you're wanting to do. Respond to all the bids that are given by the other child, because as we know, sometimes kids on the spectrum, their communication may look a little different than the sibling's peers in the classroom. And so we want to help that sibling understand, well, even if it might look like your sister's kind of talking to herself, why don't you answer? Because that's an opportunity for you guys to have a conversation. We teach encouraging communication, so asking questions. And narrating near play, because we know from the research literature that if one child's talking about what they're doing, it oftentimes elicits that same interaction from the child on the spectrum, and they'll start talking about what they're doing. So that's one component. We work with the siblings to help them learn strategies of how they might facilitate the social interactions they have with their sibling on the spectrum. And one thing I want to say about that that's really important for us is that we want to, as much as possible, promote an equality in the relationship and a balance in the relationship. I've seen sometimes where programs will use like peer buddies or other children to support skills of kids who have communication challenges, and they can inadvertently and really subconsciously kind of cause an inequity in the relationship. Things like, oh, come on, come help Joey. You know, he really needs your help, or I'll give you extra computer time if you do this. And so, you know, that's not our philosophy at all, because we don't believe that builds a longstanding relationship that both kids feel equally engaged in. And so we're very matter-of-fact when we work with a sibling. We'll say things, and we don't tell the sibling that their brother or sister has autism. We say, hey, have you ever noticed that sometimes when you try to get Joey's attention, it seems like he doesn't quite hear you. I've got some ideas for how, you know, you might try to get his attention. And so that's how we really present things, is just that, that here's some ideas that you might try out, and not that someone else has more power in the relationship than the other person. So that's the peer mediation piece, and I've been talking a lot. So let me talk.
No, I'm listening.
Keep
going,
Karen, and then I'll go on to the other piece.
Okay. Yeah. No. I'm listening in, and I think it's pretty fascinating. I did have a question. What ages is this most effective with, or what ages are you working with, I should say, maybe?
Great question. So currently we're working with kids on the spectrum who are between the ages of 4 and 7, and we're working with their siblings who have no history of social communication challenges between the ages of 5 and 10, and there's no more than 3 years age difference between them, and they reside in the same home. And really those parameters were selected based on the previous research. But also, you know, inherent in a research study is that you have to put certain parameters around things just so that you can reduce some of the variables that may impact the outcomes. And so I think clinically we can certainly serve a broader range of kids with this kind of methodology. It's just that we've narrowed it, again, because this is a research study. However, our original pilot actually had kids who were a little bit younger than this, and the family felt that they had a lot of success. And so I don't like to have folks think that this could, you know, is limited to a certain age range for kids. The other piece to it is previous literature has found that this type of intervention might be most beneficial to kids who have verbal language using maybe our parameter is 3 words or up average per sentence per utterance, and then also this might be the best match for kids who aren't severely cognitively impaired. Having said that, again, I don't know that clinically someone couldn't be using these methods, and of course taking careful data to see if it's a good match for those families, but those are some of the parameters that were put on this current study.
Okay.
The other piece to the – oh, sorry, excuse me.
Oh, no, go ahead. You're fine.
I was just going to say the other part to this, because I had mentioned there are two pieces to it, two methods that have been found effective for targeting social communication skills. So that's the one piece is the sibling mediation. The second piece is, and we would call the sibling mediation an indirect method, and the reason why is because we're working with the sibling to enact what we hope to be changes for the child on the spectrum, but it's an indirect route to take to enact those changes. One of the things that we wanted to do was also make sure that we were working directly with the child on the spectrum. And so we chose to do so using what's called video modeling. And video modeling is a method where you, essentially what it sounds like, you videotape a particular behavior, social behavior, communicative behavior, play behavior, and then you play it back for the child on the spectrum and they practice it. And so what we do is we work with a family to develop particular goals or objectives that they're interested in working on. One of the most popular ones so far was winning and losing a game, because that's sure tricky. So we videotape, and actually the sibling serves as the model. We videotape multiple instances of what that looks like, because one of the paramount tenets of pivotal response training is that we work with kids in ways that they can respond to multiple cues. We don't want them just to learn one way of doing something. And so we'll show at least 3 to 5 examples in the video of, like, different ways you could win or lose a game. Oh, oh, I lost, maybe I'll win next time, let's play again, or, oh, you won, high five, you know, different things like that, so that they see lots of different examples of how to do it. Then we actually put our videos on mini iPads, because that seems to make it cool to watch,
yeah.
And then we, and our students, they'll, they'll make the video, and then they edit it down, so we just have those examples that are really clear, and then we watch it all together. And so they watch it with the kids, and it gives us the opportunity to pause and say, oh, look, you know, he won, and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Let's see if they're going to play again. You know, you can make that particular behavior really salient for the child. And that's really the theory behind it, is that we're not doing anything really differently than you would see in the natural environment, but sometimes the distractions that occur in the natural environment make it really hard for some kids on the spectrum to pick up that skill just from observing it while it's going on in real time. So this gives us the opportunity to make that behavior really clear for the child on the spectrum, and we stop and we talk about it, and then we have them, you know, identify it, and then we practice that skill with the exact same activity that was in the video model. And we support the child in demonstrating and practicing the behavior. And then we fade those supports as they become more successful. And so the video model piece is the direct intervention piece for the child on the spectrum. And the sibling mediation is the indirect piece. And we combine those two together. And so those are the methods that we're using. We kind of counterbalance them. So we're kind of switching back and forth between the two so that they can build upon each other and support each other. The second layer to this study is, not only are we working, obviously, to serve families on the spectrum and improve these social communication skills for the kids, but we also have another aim, and that is that there is very good research to show that kids on the spectrum oftentimes are being served by professionals who just have not had very much autism-specific training. And so there is a need for us to think really carefully and clearly and design ways to train not only pre-professionally, but professionally, clinicians and educators and anyone who's going to be serving kids and families on the spectrum. And so one of our aims is to provide that opportunity. We are really fortunate through the wonderful partnership here in the Department of Speech and Hearing Sciences between our clinical faculty and academic faculty. And Claudia Meyer is our clinic director, and she's been really gracious in allowing us to actually run this research project through the speech and language clinic here at PSU. And so what happens is that our graduate student clinicians who are here receiving their master's degrees in speech-language pathology are able to take, quote-unquote, our clinic as a practicum experience. And we then train them to serve the families using this model. And so we pair up graduate student clinicians with sibling dyads. And so there's one clinician for the child on the spectrum, and there's one clinician for the sibling. And each of them works with that child to achieve their goals, and then we bring it all together really naturalistically. And the really lovely thing that, again, our research funding allows us to do is to provide what's called an apprenticeship model of supervision. And so our supervisor, Tammy Bailey, who's had many years of working with kids on the spectrum, is actually able to be with our students 100% of the time. And she actually starts in the clinic room with the students and models for them different ways to work on these different skills. And then she fades her support, her direct support and direct modeling as the term goes on. And so we see kind of this parallel thing. We're teaching the kids new skills, and as their skills develop, we fade our supports as clinicians. And then we're training these clinicians, and as we see their skills develop, we fade our supports as supervisors. And so I'm really, really pleased to say that over the last year, we've served 20 children, and we've trained 20 clinicians.
Wow, that's great. And the clinicians you're training are going to end up training so many more.
Absolutely.
Children. And yes. I wanted to ask a quick question. I've been listening to you talk about the model, but I was wondering where the potential parent involvement would be during the research program. Are they watching what's going on from another room, or How do they get involved as well with knowing that's, what you're teaching?
That's a great question, Karen. And again, we are really family-centered. And so we establish our goals right at the very start. The children receive 10 weeks of intervention, 2 times a week for 50 minutes. And so they're essentially receiving 20 therapy visits. And so we jump right into intervention. I do assessments with the kids before they start, so we have a sense of where we want to start. And then the very first session, the clinicians have come to the family with different ideas about goals that they have based on the assessments that they've observed. But then the family really drives the goal making, and they say, you know what, this is really what's important to us. We want to work on this piece or this piece. So we establish the goals right there in that first session or at the most at the second session, and we jump right in to intervention. And we have then families who have lots of different levels of engagement, basically, during this current study, and I'll tell you about something we're planning in just a minute. So we have families who are watching and observing, literally taking notes at every session and then really implementing a lot of those things at home, or we have families who are using this as an opportunity to, you know, speak with me and speak with Tammy and get some questions answered. Or we do have families who maybe need a little break, and they'll go take a coffee and then come back, and we'll inform them. So we don't we want families to feel like their involvement is driven by them. And we absolutely want them to be as involved as they would like to be. We currently don't have kind of a standardized way for involving families or any kind of parent training component. Having said that, I'm really fortunate in that we received PSU has some really great mechanisms for promoting research, and my colleagues Lou Bank and Christina Nicolaitis in the School of Social Work and I, we were fortunate enough to receive a small grant that allows us to work on developing a larger project. And so what we actually are currently working on is developing a very specific training program, a parent training program that would correspond with social SIBs, and we'll be piloting that in the spring. And what would happen is that our families, one session a week would be open for them to observe what's going on, and we would have some kind of way to help frame that observation, and then one time a week over the 10 weeks, they would be actually receiving some direct supports themselves and parent training around different topics that would be pertinent to the work that we're doing, as well as just general things that have been found helpful for parents. And so that's in development right now, and we're looking forward to piloting that project in spring term.
Well, I'm sure you will have a lot of interest in that as well. It sounds very interesting to me as a parent of two children on the spectrum and being on the spectrum myself. When our youngest was diagnosed, at the time that he stopped speaking, later he ended up getting those verbal skills back, but we were looking for any type of intervention that we could use that we would be able to model outside of just the research, you know, like, and so being able to, like, go to you and watch what you're doing and being able to get some support and then be able to bring that back into the home environment where we're living, you know, all the time is very meaningful. So I'm glad that you're doing things like that.
Absolutely. And I will say one of my goals in our current project, Karen, is that every family leaves here feeling confident in making their own video model at home. And, you know, I give the families the resources and support them in doing that. And, you know, oftentimes this is something that families don't necessarily need a lot of extra technology. You know, most of our phones these days will take a video really quickly, or a lot of families have access to doing those kinds of things. And so one of my major goals, even though, like I say, we don't have like a standardized parent training in our current project, is that families leave here with the knowledge to make video models on their own and understanding what pivotal response training means and how to continue to work with the sibling on different strategies that may be of interest to that family. I am very quick to give families not only kind of educational information, but also the research as well, because I think that that it's really important for them to understand kind of the theoretical foundation for what we're doing, and then I'm always available to answer questions if folks are interested. And so that's definitely a goal that we have, is that they can walk out of here after 10 weeks and film their own video model and support that sibling with teaching the next strategy that's on their list.
And I think that's so important, knowing that they're having, you know, it's not just 10 weeks and then bye. You know, they're being empowered to do things. And now that they've gotten this great intervention started, that they're able to take it from there. As far as the sibling-mediated intervention goes, you say that they come there for 10 weeks. Do they have, I guess I should say, what's the question I'm going to ask? Do they have homework that happens at home, like where the things that they're modeling there at the sessions they're supposed to do at home throughout the week too? Or how does that all tie in for you to be able to see how effective it is and how it's I don't know if I'm asking the right question, but how
that's a great question. I just didn't want to cut you off at the end if you had another part of it. I think we try to very much individualize it for families. We have families who, for example, the siblings take home different things that our clinicians have made for them, different visual reminders. We've set up kind of reinforcement systems at home. You know, the parent has set up little reminders around the house, and then if they see the sibling, you know, do three of the strategies at home before the next session, then they get, you know, a special whatever it is that they've decided for their family. So we absolutely encourage families to do, again, as much at home as feels comfortable to them. And we have a lot of families who seek that out, and we readily supply them with the materials and the ideas that seem appropriate. Having said that, we don't insist that families do that at home. I will say anecdotally, and we don't have our data in yet because this is a 2-year study, but anecdotally, we certainly can see a lot of changes in families that are working on these skills at home in terms of their perception of the overall changes they see in their children. So what I mean by that is some of our families who practice things at home, they can see carryover and generalization very, very quickly oftentimes. What comes to mind is actually the family that we first piloted this project with, and it was a pair of sisters. And one of the first strategies we taught the sibling was gaining attention, and we showed her different strategies like tapping her sister's shoulder and making sure she was standing in close proximity and looking at her and then saying her name. And these were very young children, 4 and 5 years of age. And in fact, the mom came back and reported that and this was a significant family change for them. They had gotten together with their extended family, and in the past, reportedly, the cousins would all play with the sibling, and the child on the spectrum kind of just did their own thing. And so the family was really excited to report that completely spontaneously on her own, the sibling went up and taught all of her other 4 and 5-year-old cousins how to gain the attention of their cousin on the spectrum. And for kind of the first time ever, the child on the spectrum joined in all the cousin play during that visit. So that was really powerful for that family. And those are the kinds of things that, to be frank, I'm most interested in, is what kinds of changes can we see, not just here at the clinic, but that the family kind of really feels make a difference for them at home.
That's a great story. I mean, I love that, especially since they're so young, to know that they took what they learned, and obviously, you know, there was no ulterior motive logically thinking this whole thing out. They just wanted to be able to have their sister, their brother, the sister join in, and that's really cool. I love that. Thank you
absolutely
for sharing.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the things that we're most interested in, because we individualize the goals for these families, I think one of the reasons, if you look at the social communication intervention research, that they are oftentimes studies of just a few children at a time. And this is actually a fairly large study. By the end of 2 years, we'll have worked with 24 families and we'll have trained 48 clinicians. And so the reason that can be challenging is because what might be a social communication goal for one family is not the same for another family. And what we're doing is we're able to work on these individual family-based goals with each of these families, yet what we hypothesize and what I hope that we see at the end of these 2 years is that we're going to see overall change. Just the fact that we're working on social communication skills actually will benefit the overall social interaction. And so our measures that we take as part of the research project are how engaged the kids are with each other, how much they're initiating with each other, how much they are responding to each other. And so across the course of the 10 weeks, we do these 10-minute interaction sessions, which are completely outside of our teaching. They're called probe data because they don't provide the kids any other supports, just like if they were home and they were just playing together. We give them 10 minutes to play together, and we do it before we start intervention. We do it at week 4, we do it at week 8, and then we do it 1 month, and at week 10 and 1 month follow-up. And what we look for across those 10-minute segments is we can oftentimes, and this is what we've seen, again, speaking about that pilot family, the first 10 minutes we saw those kids, they basically just sat and did their own thing for 10 minutes. And in fact, the sibling kind of kept moving her body to protect her toys, because what had happened is her sibling on the spectrum, I guess, would often take her toys, and so she was very protective of them. And our 10-minute segment at the end was them putting a puzzle together and talking to each other about each piece, and then they had put the puzzle all together, then they decided to stomp on the puzzle, then they decided to lay down on the puzzle. And my philosophy is, I don't care if they're stomping on a puzzle, I'm just glad they're playing together. You know, it was a big floor puzzle. So we don't get wrapped up in all this.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah, like we're not tied to, like, sit properly, you know, don't say a word, kind of. No, we're all about having fun. Which actually is one major point I want to say, because I know we're running out of time. Motivation is the key. There's lots of literature that says if we include highly preferred objects or activities in the way that we teach with kids on the spectrum, then we see these great benefits to behaviors that we're not even working on, and we see the social interaction. So our philosophy is very much, every family who comes, they fill out what's called a play interest survey, and it's from Kathleen Quill's book. And so we know what motivates these kids, both the siblings and the child on the spectrum. And we teach within that context. So, for example, there's a bowling alley right next door here at PSU. And if we've got kids who like bowling, we never would say, okay, do a quote-unquote, good job for 10 weeks, and then at the end we'll go bowling. If those kids like to bowl, we go down and we go bowling, and we teach while we're bowling, because it's really important for them to be engaged and motivated in what we're doing, because that actually makes them more open to learning than if we were doing something where we had to give them, you know, give them a candy or something just to pay attention. So that's really our philosophy here.
So you're tailoring and you're customizing it to their interests.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
So, what are you hoping to have happen after the study is complete? I know you're going into your second year, but are you hoping that this is a program that can be replicated around the country, or what are the long-reaching implications?
Sure, that's a great question, Karen. I actually, this project's really close to my heart. I have a lot of dreams for this project. My first one is sustainability. Firmly believe that we have the potential to impact the community, not only with working with the families, but with training these clinicians, as I said. And so I really would love to see us have the ability to continue to be able to provide this service to our community through PSU Speech and Language Clinic, and provide this service to our graduate student clinicians so that they can go out into the community and be well-trained in serving families with kids on the spectrum. So next steps are securing more funding and resources for us to be able to do that. And one of the things that my colleagues and I are doing, as I said, is working towards the next step, which would be that parent training component. But I also would love to see this move into a development. We're in the development phase right now. Move this into an efficacy phase where we really are then seeing other sites. It could be community sites, it could be other university training programs who are employing this model as well, and provide these services to children and families in the community, and provide we keep fine tuning this training model, and I'm really feeling very committed to it, and I would really love to see that training model replicated, because we can, I believe, and you know, the data will bear this out, but I believe we can be doing these things simultaneously. We can be providing services to families, and we can be training evidence-based practices to new clinicians, and that's what we need given our current community needs for well-trained clinicians and families who need services. And of course, I can't predict exactly what our data are going to show in terms of those social engagement measures, but I will say anecdotally, we do a parent interview at the end of the 1 month follow-up, and I would say nearly universally, our families have felt that they have seen a daily impact in terms of whether it's how the kids interact with each other or how often they seek each other out to play, or like the example of teaching extended family. And so that's really hopeful to me in terms of what I hope our data will show us at the end of next year.
That's great. I appreciate you taking the time to answer that. And if I'm... A lot of our listeners are from the Southwest Washington, Portland metro area. Some are definitely from other areas of the country. But if I'm listening in and I'm a parent and I'm in the area and I'm interested in potentially having my children become involved, what would be the process? How would they get in touch? What are the parameters for that?
Absolutely. So they would be welcome to email or call me. My email address is adonald@pdx.edu, and my phone number at PSU is 503-725-3224, and they would give me a call or shoot me an email, and I would connect with them and talk a lot about the study and if it was a good match for the family, and then if it seemed to be, I would send them our consent forms for participating, and they would review them, and I would answer any questions. And if they still felt it was a good match, then once we received the signed consent forms, then we would schedule their assessments. In order for us to know whether or not this is effective, we can't just look at the kids' performance after 10 weeks. We actually have to compare them to something. We have to compare them to kids who are not receiving the intervention, because that gives us a good ability to say then if we think this is effective or not. And so one of the ways we do this from a research perspective is through the way we've designed the study. And so we actually have just finished up our current recruitment period for this time, and the way that it works is that I do the initial assessments with the children who have whose families are interested in participating, and then actually our research coordinator, Alex Davidson, she uses a computer program to randomly place the families either into immediate intervention, which is the winter term here at PSU from January through March, or into later intervention, and that intervention would then be April through June. And so what happens is those families who have randomly been placed into the later intervention slot, we actually follow them during this winter term. We have them come in two times to do that 10-week interaction or 10-minute interaction that I talked about, because then we can compare their performance before they received intervention to their performance after they received intervention to say if the intervention is effective. So if a family was to come in we would do the assessment, then they would receive their placement in terms of either immediate intervention or later intervention, and then we would work with them for 10 weeks wherever they fell out in that continuum or that timeline, and then we would see them again 1 month afterwards.
Great. So that kind of gives that baseline. So you're even though they're not getting the social communication piece right away, they're still part of the process.
Absolutely. And that's actually what helps us understand, like I say, whether this is effective or not. Because one of the things that might happen is they might actually gain skills without us, and we would need a way to monitor that. So by following that one group who falls into later intervention for those 10 weeks, then we can look at our data at the end, and if we don't see a change for those 10 weeks, then we see a change once we provide intervention, then we can feel more confident that it was our intervention that that was the responsible for that change.
And, of course, obviously you want to be able to know that, for your study purposes. And it sounds like what you're doing is really, really very important, because being able to have siblings work with each other, what you were saying earlier is, with peer-based mediation, those peers, they might move away, they might go away, but siblings, you're hoping that they're going to be there for life, and that's just going to be that story, the anecdote that you shared about the sister who had taken some of what she learned and then applied it to extended family. That's just making such a world of difference for those children. And
It really is. And I know we're out of time, but if I could leave with one last reflection, actually, from that family, that same family, and this is. Been probably one of the most impactful things since we started this process, at least for me. And the parents shared with us, and again, these children were 4 and 5, and they shared with us that the sibling had basically, in their words, quote unquote, given up on her younger sister, and now she found her again. And I will continue doing anything I can to have families feel that way, because I think that's so important. At 4 and 5, we don't want siblings who feel like they don't have a relationship to come. So we want to make sure that families, that whole dynamic of the family can feel that way.
Well, that's wonderful. And I hope that people who are listening today, that if they're interested in getting involved with this, that they will go ahead and contact Amy. We also have her email address and phone number at our website. She'll have a special page on our website as well, in case you didn't catch that information. We'll also post information about the study on our Facebook page. That'll also be that's also on our website too. We have just a couple minutes here. Yes, we ran a little bit over time, but I'm not cutting you off here. If you have anything that you want to share in the last couple minutes with our listeners, we would be delighted to have you do so. And I just want to thank you before that for taking the time to come on air today and share all of the great, valuable things that are going on with the Social SIBS Project.
Well, I would just like to share that I'm so pleased to be part of this community and thankful for all of the wonderful collaborations and community interest in what we're doing and participation, and that I'm really looking forward to continuing to build that. And we would certainly not be able to look at some of these questions, which I think are so important to me, is to feel like I can have some confidence when I tell a family that, this might be effective for your child. Certainly we know there's not one intervention that's going to be effective for every child on the spectrum, but it's very important to me as a researcher and as a clinical scientist and as a speech-language pathologist to feel like what I'm recommending to a family is rooted in evidence, so that they're not scrambling like how I started my career and what I felt like when I decided to go back is that's really what drives me every day. And so I thank the community for being part of this. It's a process that we all work on together. And thank you so much, Karen, for having me on. It's been a pleasure, and for all of the work that you do in the community, and John as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Amy. And, you know, what you're doing in helping these families and also in helping to train clinicians that are going to be working with so many kids, you're just sending out this positive ripple effect into our community. And wherever those students end up, where they're teaching in practice, they're going to be making positive differences. And I just like the touch of the culture that you're sharing. Everything that you share today just showed what a quality person you are and how the work that you're doing is so meaningful. And we are so delighted to have you doing what you're doing in our community. So thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much.
And you're very welcome. And with that, everybody, I would like to keep talking to her for longer, but we're out of time today. This is Karen Krejcha with Autism Empowerment Radio. I just spoke with Dr. Amy Donaldson. And, wow, Social SIPS Project, really great evidence-based research, helping our children on the spectrum. Get connected with them. Check our website at autismempowerment.org if you want to connect with Amy. If you're in the area and you have children on the spectrum who might be interested in being involved in that study, or if you just want to go ahead and connect and learn a little bit more about what they're doing and support some of the projects that they have in development, I'm sure they would be happy to hear from you. This has been Karen Krejcha, and we look forward to talking with you again next time. Thank you again, Amy, and have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.